Part 6. The International Economy. Chapter 21. International Trade. Facts are stubborn things, and whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passions, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence. John Adams. When discussing the historic North American Free Trade Agreement of 1993, NAFTA, the New York Times said, "Abundant evidence is emerging that jobs are shifting across borders too rapidly to declare the United States a job winner or a job loser from the trade agreement." Posing the issue in these terms committed the central fallacy in many discussions of international trade, assuming that one country must be a loser if the other country is a winner. But international trade is not a zero-sum contest. Both sides must gain, or it would make no sense to continue trading. Nor is it necessary for experts or government officials to determine whether both sides are gaining. Most international trade, like most domestic trade, is done by millions of individuals, each of whom can determine whether the item purchased is worth what it cost and is preferable to what is available from others. As for jobs, before the NAFTA Free Trade Agreement among the United States, Canada, and Mexico went into effect, there were dire predictions of a giant sucking sound as jobs would be sucked out of the United States to Mexico because of Mexico's lower wage rates. In reality, the number of American jobs increased after the agreement, and the unemployment rate in the United States fell over the next 7 years from more than 7% down to 4%, the lowest level seen in decades. In Canada, the unemployment rate fell from 11% to 7% over the same 7 years. Why was what happened so radically different from what was predicted? Let's go back to square one. What happens when a given country, in isolation, becomes more prosperous? It tends to buy more because it has more to buy with. And what happens when it buys more? There are more jobs created for workers producing the additional goods and services. Make that two countries, and the principle remains the same. Indeed, make it any number of countries, and the principle remains the same. Rising prosperity usually means rising employment. There is no fixed number of jobs that countries must fight over. When countries become more prosperous, they all tend to create more jobs. The only question is whether international trade tends to make countries more prosperous. Mexico was considered to be the main threat to take jobs away from the United States when trade barriers were lowered, because wage rates are much lower in Mexico. In the post-NAFTA years, jobs did in fact increase by the millions in Mexico, at the same time when jobs were increasing by the millions in the United States. Both countries saw an increase in their international trade, with especially sharp increases in those goods covered by NAFTA. The basic facts about international trade are not difficult to understand. What is difficult to untangle are all the misconceptions and jargon which so often clutter up the discussion. The great U.S. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said, "We need to think things instead of words." Nowhere is that more important than when discussing international trade, where there are so many misleading and emotional words used to describe and confuse things that are not very difficult to understand in themselves. For example, the terminology used to describe an export surplus as a favorable balance of trade and an import surplus as an unfavorable balance of trade goes back for centuries. At one time, it was widely believed that importing more than was exported impoverished a nation because the difference between imports and exports had to be paid in gold, and the loss of gold was seen as a loss of national wealth. However, as early as 1776, Adam Smith's classic The Wealth of Nations argued that the real wealth of a nation consists of its goods and services, not its gold supply. Too many people have yet to grasp the full implications of that, even in the 21st century. If the goods and services available to the American people are greater as a result of international trade, then Americans are wealthier, not poorer, regardless of whether there is a deficit or a surplus in the international balance of trade. Incidentally, during the Great Depression of the 1930s, the United States had an export surplus, a favorable balance of trade, in every year of that disastrous decade. But what may be more relevant is that both imports and exports were sharply lower than they had been during the prosperous decade of the 1920s. This reduction in international trade was a result of rising tariff barriers in countries around the world, as nations attempted to save jobs in their own domestic economies during a period of widespread unemployment by keeping out international trade. Such policies have been regarded by many economists as needlessly worsening and prolonging the worldwide depression. The last thing needed when real national income is going down is a policy that makes it go down faster by denying consumers the benefits of being able to buy what they want at the lowest price available. Slippery words can make bad news look like good news, and vice versa. For example, the much-lamented international trade deficit of the United States narrowed by a record-breaking amount in the spring of 2001, as Businessweek magazine reported under the headline, "A Shrinking Trade Gap Looks Good Stateside." However, this happened while the stock market was falling, unemployment was rising, corporate profits were down, and the total output of the American economy declined. The supposedly good news on international trade was due to reduced imports during shaky economic times. Had the country gone into a deep depression, the international trade balance might have disappeared completely, but fortunately, Americans were spared that much good news. Just as the United States had a favorable balance of trade in every year of the Great Depression of the 1930s, it became a record-breaking debtor nation during the booming prosperity of the 1990s. Obviously, such words cannot be taken at face value as indicators of the economic well-being of a country. We will need to examine more closely what such words mean in context. The basis for international trade. While international trade takes place for the same reason that other trades take place, because both sides gain, it is necessary to understand just why both countries gain, especially since there are so many politicians and journalists who muddy the waters with claims to the contrary. The reasons why countries gain from international trade are usually grouped together by economists under three categories: absolute advantage, comparative advantage, and economies of scale. Absolute advantage. It is obvious why Americans buy bananas grown in the Caribbean. Bananas can be grown much more cheaply in the tropics than in places where greenhouses and other artificial means of maintaining warmth would be necessary. In tropical countries, nature provides free the warmth that people have to provide by costly means in cooler climates, such as that of the United States. Therefore, it pays Americans to buy bananas grown in the tropics, rather than grow them at higher costs within the United States. Sometimes the advantages that one country has over another, or over the rest of the world, are extreme. Growing coffee, for example, requires a peculiar combination of climatic conditions, warm but not too hot, nor with sunlight beating down on the plants directly all day, nor with too much moisture or too little moisture, and in some kinds of soils but not others. Putting together these and other requirements for ideal coffee growing conditions drastically reduces the number of places that are best suited for producing coffee. In the early 21st century, more than half the coffee in the entire world was grown in just three countries: Brazil, Vietnam, and Colombia. This does not mean that other countries were completely incapable of growing coffee. It is just that the amount and quality of coffee that most countries could produce would not be worth the resources it would cost, when coffee can be bought from these three countries at a lower cost. Sometimes an absolute advantage consists simply of being located in the right place or speaking the right language. In India, for example, the time is about 12 hours different from the time in the United States, which means that an American company, which wants round-the-clock computer services, can engage a computer company in India to have Indian technicians available when it is night in the United States and day in India. Since many educated people in India speak English, and India has 30% of all the computer software engineers in the world, this combination of circumstances gives India a large advantage in competing for computer services in the American market. Similarly, South American countries supply fruits and vegetables to North American countries when it is winter in the Northern Hemisphere and summer in the Southern Hemisphere. These are all examples of what economists call absolute advantage. One country, for any of a number of reasons, can produce some things cheaper or better than another. Those reasons may be due to climate, geography, or the mixture of skills in their respective populations. Foreigners who buy that country's products benefit from the lower costs, while the country itself obviously benefits from the larger market for its products or services, and sometimes from the fact that part of the inputs needed to create the product are free, such as warmth in the tropics or rich nutrients in the soil in various places around the world. There is another more subtle, but at least equally important, reason for international trade. This is what economists call comparative advantage. Comparative advantage. To illustrate what is meant by comparative advantage, suppose that one country is so efficient that it is capable of producing anything more cheaply than a neighboring country. Is there any benefit that the more efficient country can gain from trading with its neighbor? Yes. Why? Because being able to produce anything more cheaply is not the same as being able to produce everything more cheaply. When there are scarce resources which have alternative uses, producing more of one product means producing less of some other product. The question is not simply how much it costs, in either money or resources, to produce chairs or television sets in one country compared to another country, but how many chairs it costs to produce a television set, when resources are shifted from producing one product to producing the other. If that trade-off is different between two countries, then the country that can get more television sets by foregoing the production of chairs can benefit from trading with the country that gets more chairs by not producing television sets. A numerical example can illustrate this point. Assume that an average American worker produces 500 chairs a month, while an average Canadian worker produces 450, and that an American worker can produce 200 television sets a month, while a Canadian worker produces 100. But what would the output be, under these conditions, if both countries produced both products versus each country producing only one of these products? Assume the same respective outputs per worker and the same total number of workers, 500, devoted to producing these products in each country. With both countries producing both products, under the conditions specified, their combined output would come to a grand total of 190,000 chairs and 90,000 television sets per month, from a grand total of 1,000 workers. What if the two countries specialize, with the United States putting all its chair-producing workers into the production of television sets instead, and Canada doing the reverse? Then, with the very same output per worker as before in each country, they can now produce a larger grand total of the two products from the same 1,000 workers. Without any change in the productivity of workers in either country, the total output is now greater from the same number of workers, that output now being 100,000 television sets instead of 90,000 and 225,000 chairs instead of 190,000. That is because each country now produces where it has a comparative advantage, whether or not it has an absolute advantage. Economists would say that the United States has an absolute advantage in producing both products, but that Canada has a comparative advantage in producing chairs. That is, Canada sacrifices fewer television sets by shifting resources to the production of chairs than the United States would by such a shift. Under these conditions, Americans can get more chairs by producing television sets and trading them with Canadians for chairs, instead of by producing their own chairs directly. Conversely, Canadians can get more television sets by producing chairs and trading them for American-made television sets, rather than producing television sets themselves. Only if the United States produced everything more efficiently than Canada by the same percentage for each product would there be no gain from trade, because there would then be no comparative advantage. Such a situation is virtually impossible to find in the real world. Similar principles apply on a personal level in everyday life. Imagine, for example, that you are an eye surgeon and that you paid your way through college by washing cars. Now that you have a car of your own, should you wash it yourself? Or should you hire someone else to wash it, even if your previous experience allows you to do the job in less time than the person you hire? Obviously, it makes no sense to you financially or to society in terms of overall well-being for you to be spending your time sudsing down an automobile instead of being in an operating room saving someone's eyesight. In other words, even though you have an absolute advantage in both activities, your comparative advantage in treating eye diseases is far greater. The key to understanding both individual examples and examples from international trade is the basic economic reality of scarcity. The surgeon has only 24 hours in the day, like everyone else. Time that he is spending doing one thing is time taken away from doing something else. The same is true of countries, which do not have an unlimited amount of labor, time, or other resources, and so must do one thing at the cost of not doing something else. That is the very meaning of economic costs. Foregone alternatives, which apply whether the particular economy is capitalist, socialist, feudal, or whatever, and whether the transactions are domestic or international. The benefits of comparative advantage are particularly important to poorer countries. Someone put it this way: comparative advantage means there is a place under the free trade sun for every nation, no matter how poor, because people of every nation can produce some products relatively more efficiently than they produce other products. Comparative advantage is not just a theory, but a very important fact in the history of many nations. It has been more than a century since Great Britain produced enough food to feed its people. Britons have been able to get enough to eat only because the country has concentrated its efforts on producing those things in which it has had a comparative advantage, such as manufacturing, shipping, and financial services, and using the proceeds to buy food from other countries. British consumers ended up better fed and with more manufactured goods than if the country grew enough of its own food to feed itself. Since the real costs of anything that is produced are the other things that could have been produced with the same efforts, it would cost the British too much industry and commerce to transfer enough resources into agriculture to become self-sufficient in food. They are better off getting food from some other country whose comparative advantage is in agriculture, even if that other country's farmers are not as efficient as British farmers. Such a trade-off is not limited to industrialized nations. When cocoa began to be grown on farms in West Africa, which ultimately produced over half of the world's supply, African farmers reduced the amount of food they grew in order to earn more money by planting cocoa trees on their lands instead of food crops. As a result, their increased earnings enabled them to live off food produced elsewhere. This food included not only meat and vegetables grown in the region, but also imported rice and canned fish and fruit, the latter items being considered to be luxuries at the time. Economies of scale. While absolute advantage and comparative advantage are the key reasons for benefits from international trade, they are not the only reasons. Sometimes a particular product requires such huge investment in machinery, in the engineering required to create the machinery and the product, as well as in developing a specialized labor force, that the resulting output can be sold at a low enough price to be competitive only when some enormous amount of output is produced, because of economies of scale, as discussed in Chapter 6. It has been estimated that the minimum output of automobiles needed to achieve an efficient cost per car is somewhere between 200,000 and 400,000 automobiles per year. Producing in such huge quantities is not a serious problem in a country of the size and wealth of the United States, where each of the big three domestic automakers, Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler, has had at least one vehicle with sales of more than 400,000, as did Toyota, while the Ford F-Series pickup truck has had more than 800,000 annual sales. But in a country with a much smaller population, Australia, for example, there is no way to sell enough cars within the country to be able to cover the high costs of developing automobiles from scratch to sell at prices low enough to compete with automobiles produced in much larger quantities in the United States or Japan. The largest number of cars of any given make sold in Australia is only about half of the quantity needed to reap all the cost benefits of economies of scale. While the number of automobiles owned per capita is higher in Australia than in the United States, there are more than a dozen times as many Americans as there are Australians. Even those cars which have been manufactured in Australia have been developed in other countries. Toyotas and Mitsubishis from Japan, and Ford and General Motors cars from the United States. They are essentially Australian-built Japanese or American cars, which means that companies in Japan and the United States have already paid the huge engineering, research, and other costs of creating these vehicles. But the Australian market is not large enough to achieve sufficient economies of scale to produce original Australian automobiles from scratch at a cost that would enable them to compete in the market with imported cars. Although Australia is a modern, prosperous country, with output per person higher than that of Great Britain, Canada, or the United States, its small population limits its total purchasing power to 1/5 that of Japan and 1/17 that of the United States. Exports enable some countries to achieve economies of scale that would not be possible from domestic sales alone. Some business enterprises make most of their sales outside their respective countries' borders. For example, Heineken does not have to depend on the small Holland market for its beer sales, since it sells beer in 170 other countries. Nokia sells its phones around the world, not just in its native Finland. The distinguished British magazine The Economist sells 3 times as many copies in the United States as in Britain. Toyota, Honda, and Nissan all earned most of their profits in North America, and Japanese automakers as a whole began in 2006 to manufacture more cars outside of Japan than in Japan itself. Small countries like South Korea and Taiwan depend on international trade to be able to produce many products on a scale far exceeding what can be sold domestically. In short, international trade is necessary for many countries to achieve economies of scale that will enable them to sell at prices that can compete with the prices of similar products in the world market. For some products requiring huge investments in machinery and research, only a very few large and prosperous countries could reach the levels of output needed to repay all these costs from domestic sales alone. International trade creates greater efficiency by allowing more economies of scale around the world, even in countries whose domestic markets are not large enough to absorb all the output of mass production industries, as well as by taking advantage of each country's absolute or comparative advantages. As in other cases, we can sometimes understand the benefits of a particular way of doing things by seeing what happens when they are done differently. For many years, India encouraged small businesses and maintained barriers against imports that could compete with them. However, the lifting of import restrictions at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century changed all that. As the Far Eastern Economic Review put it, "The nightmare of the Indian toy industry comes in the form of a pint-sized plastic doll. It's made in China, sings a popular Hindi film song, and costs about 100 rupees. $2. Indian parents have snapped it up at markets across the country, leaving local toy companies petrified. Matching the speed, scale, and technology involved in the doll's production, resulting in its rock-bottom price, is beyond their abilities. In areas such as toys and shoes, China has developed huge economies of scale, while India has kept its producers artificially small." The economic problems of toy manufacturers in India under free trade are overshadowed by the far more serious problems created by previous import restrictions, which forced hundreds of millions of people in a very poor country to pay needlessly inflated prices for a wide range of products because of policies protecting small-scale producers from the competition of larger producers at home and abroad. Fortunately, decades of such policies were finally ended in India in the last decade of the 20th century. International trade restrictions. While there are many advantages to international trade for the world as a whole and for countries individually, like all forms of greater economic efficiency, whether at home or abroad, it displaces less efficient ways of doing things. Just as the advent of the automobile inflicted severe losses on the horse and buggy industry, and the spread of giant supermarket chains drove many small neighborhood grocery stores out of business, so imports of things in which other countries have a comparative advantage create losses of revenue and jobs in the corresponding domestic industry. Despite offsetting economic gains that typically far outweigh the losses, politically, it is almost inevitable that there will be loud calls for government protection from foreign competition through various restrictions against imports. Many of the most long-lived fallacies in economics have grown out of attempts to justify these international trade restrictions. Although Adam Smith refuted most of these fallacies more than 2 centuries ago, as far as economists are concerned, such fallacies remain politically alive and potent today. Some people argue, for example, that wealthy countries cannot compete with countries whose wages are much lower. Poorer countries, on the other hand, may say that they must protect their infant industries from competition with more developed industrial nations until the local industries acquire the experience and know-how to compete on even terms. In all countries, there are complaints that other nations are not being fair in their laws regarding imports and exports. A frequently heard complaint of unfairness, for example, is that some countries dump their goods on the international market at artificially low prices, losing money in the short run, in order to gain a larger market share that they will later exploit by raising prices after they achieve a monopolistic position. In the complexities of real life, seldom is any argument right 100% of the time or wrong 100% of the time. When it comes to arguments for international trade restrictions, however, most of the arguments are fallacious most of the time. Let us examine them one at a time, beginning with the high-wage fallacy. The high-wage fallacy. In a prosperous country such as the United States, a fallacy that sounds very plausible is that American goods cannot compete with goods produced by low-wage workers in poorer countries, some of whom are paid a fraction of what American workers receive. But, plausible as this may sound, both history and economics refute it. Historically, high-wage countries have been exporting to low-wage countries for centuries. The Dutch Republic was a leader in international trade for nearly a century and a half, from the 1590s to the 1740s, while having some of the highest-paid workers in the world. Britain was the world's greatest exporter in the 19th century, and its wage rates were much higher than the wage rates in many, if not most, of the countries to which it sold its goods. Conversely, India has had far lower wage rates than those in more industrialized countries like Japan and the United States, but for many years India restricted imports of automobiles and other products made in Japan and the United States because India's domestic producers could not compete in price or quality with such imported products. After an easing of restrictions on international trade, even the leading Indian industrial firm, Tata, has had to be concerned about imports from China, despite the higher wages of Chinese workers compared to workers in India. The Tata Group set up a special office to educate the different parts of its sprawling business empire on the possible fallout from the removal of import restrictions. Jiban Mukhopadhyay, economic advisor to the group's chairman, heads the operation. In his desk drawer, he keeps a silk tie bought on a trip to China. Managers who attend the company's WTO, World Trade Organization, workshops are asked to guess its price. It's only 85 rupees, he points out. A similar tie made in India would cost 400 rupees. Economically, the key flaw in the high-wage argument is that it confuses wage rates with labor costs, and labor costs with total costs. Wage rates are measured per hour of work. Labor costs are measured per unit of output. Total costs include not only the cost of labor, but also the cost of capital, raw materials, transportation, and other things needed to produce output and bring the finished product to market. When workers in a prosperous country receive wages twice as high as workers in a poorer country and produce three times the output per hour, then it is the high-wage country which has the lower labor costs per unit of output. That is, it is cheaper to get a given amount of work done in the more prosperous country simply because it takes less labor, even though individual workers are paid more for their time. The higher-paid workers may be more efficiently organized and managed, or have more or better machinery to work with, or work in companies or industries with greater economies of scale. Often, transportation costs are lower in the more developed country, so that total costs of delivering the product to market are less. There are, after all, reasons why one country is more prosperous than another in the first place, and often that reason is that they are more efficient at producing and delivering output for any of a number of reasons. In short, higher wage rates per unit of time are not the same as higher costs per unit of output. It may not even mean higher labor costs per unit of output. And, of course, labor costs are not the only costs. An international consulting firm determined that the average labor productivity in the modern sectors in India is 15% of labor productivity in the United States. In other words, if you hired an average Indian worker and paid him one-fifth of what you paid an average American worker, it would cost you more to get a given amount of work done in India than in the United States. paying 20% of what an American worker makes to someone who produces only 15% of what an American worker produces would increase your labor costs. None of this means that no low-wage country can ever gain jobs at the expense of a high-wage country, where the difference in productivity is less than the difference in wage rates, as with India's well-trained and English-speaking computer programmers, then much American computer programming will be done in India. All other forms of comparative advantage will also mean a shift of jobs to countries with particular advantages in doing particular things. But this does not imply a net loss of jobs in the economy as a whole, any more than other forms of greater efficiency, domestically or internationally, imply a net loss of jobs in the economy. The job losses are quite real to those who suffer them, whether due to domestic or international competition, but restrictions on either domestic or international markets usually cost jobs on net balance because such restrictions reduce the prosperity on which the demand for goods and labor depends. Labor costs are only part of the story. The costs of capital and management are a considerable part of the cost of many products. In some cases, capital costs exceed labor costs, especially in industries with high fixed costs, such as electric utilities and railroads, both of which have huge investments in infrastructure. A prosperous country usually has a greater abundance of capital, and, because of supply and demand, capital tends to be cheaper there than in poorer countries, where capital is more scarce and earns a correspondingly higher rate of return. The history of the beginning of the industrialization of Russia under the Tsars illustrates how the supply of capital affects the cost of capital. When Russia began a large-scale industrialization program in the 1890s, foreign investors could earn a return of 17.5% per year on their investments, until so many invested in Russia that the rate of return declined over the years and fell below 5% by 1900. Poorer countries with high capital costs would have difficulty competing with richer countries with lower capital costs, even if they had a real advantage in labor costs, which they often do not. At any given time, it is undoubtedly true that some industries will be adversely affected by competing imported products, just as they are adversely affected by every other source of cheaper or better products, whether domestic or foreign. These other sources of greater efficiency are at work all the time, forcing industries to modernize, downsize, or go out of business. Yet when this happens because of foreigners, it can be depicted politically as a case of our country versus theirs, when in fact it is the old story of domestic special interests versus consumers. Saving jobs. During periods of high unemployment, politicians are especially likely to be under great pressure to come to the rescue of particular industries that are losing money and jobs by restricting imports that compete with them. One of the most tragic examples of such restrictions occurred during the worldwide depression of the 1930s, when tariff barriers and other restrictions went up around the world. The net result was that world exports in 1933 were only one-third of what they had been in 1929. Just as free trade provides economic benefits to all countries simultaneously, so trade restrictions reduce the efficiency of all countries simultaneously, lowering standards of living without producing the increased employment that was hoped for. These trade restrictions around the world were set off by passage of the Smoot-Hawley tariffs in the United States in 1930. Which raised American tariffs on imports to record high levels. Other countries retaliated with severe restrictions on their imports of American products. Moreover, the same political pressures at work in the United States were at work elsewhere, since it seems plausible to many people to protect jobs at home by reducing imports from foreign countries. The net result was that severe international trade restrictions were applied by many countries to many other countries, not just to the United States. The net economic consequences were quite different from what was expected, but were precisely what had been predicted by more than 1,000 economists who signed a public appeal against the tariff increases, directed to Senator Smoot, Congressman Hawley, and President Herbert Hoover. Among other things, they said, "America is now facing the problem of unemployment. The proponents of higher tariffs claim that an increase in rates will give work to the idle. This is not true. We cannot increase employment by restricting trade." These 1,000 economists, including many leading professors of economics at Harvard, Columbia, and the University of Chicago, accurately predicted retaliatory tariffs against American goods by other countries. They also predicted that the vast majority of American farmers, who are among the strongest supporters of tariffs, would lose out on net balance as other countries restricted their imports of American farm products. All these predictions were fulfilled. Unemployment grew worse, and U.S. farm exports plummeted, along with a general decline in America's international trade. The unemployment rate in the United States was 6% in June 1930, when the Smoot-Hawley tariffs were passed, down from its peak of 9% in December 1929. A year later, unemployment was 15%, and a year after that, it was 26%. All of this need not be attributed to the tariffs, but the whole point of those tariffs was to reduce unemployment. At any given time, a protective tariff or other import restriction may provide immediate relief to a particular industry and thus gain the political and financial support of corporations and labor unions in that industry. But like many political benefits, it comes at the expense of others who may not be as organized, as visible, or as vocal. When the number of jobs in the American steel industry fell from 340,000 to 125,000 during the decade of the 1980s, that had a devastating impact and was big economic and political news. It also led to a variety of laws and regulations designed to reduce the amount of steel imported into the country that competed with domestically produced steel. Of course, this reduction in supply led to higher steel prices within the United States and therefore higher costs for all other American industries that were manufacturing products made of steel, which ranged from automobiles to oil rigs. All these products made of steel were now at a disadvantage in competing with similar foreign-made products, both within the United States and in international markets. It has been estimated that the steel tariffs produced $240 million in additional profits to the steel companies and saved 5,000 jobs in the steel industry. At the same time, those American industries that manufacture products made from this artificially more expensive steel lost an estimated $600 million in profits and 26,000 jobs as a result of the steel tariffs. In other words, both American industry and American workers as a whole were worse off on net balance as a result of the import restrictions on steel. Similarly, a study of restrictions on the importation of sugar into the United States indicated that while it saved jobs in the sugar industry, it cost three times as many jobs in the confection industry because of the high cost of the sugar used in making confections. Some American firms relocated to Canada and Mexico because sugar costs were lower in both these countries. In 2013, the Wall Street Journal reported, Atkinson Candy Company has moved 80% of its peppermint candy production to a factory in Guatemala that opened in 2010. From 2000 to 2012, the average price of sugar in the United States was more than double its price in the world market, according to the Wall Street Journal. International trade restrictions provide yet another example of the fallacy of composition, the belief that what is true of a part is true of the whole. There is no question that a particular industry or occupation can be benefited by international trade restrictions. The fallacy is in believing that this means the economy as a whole is benefited, whether as regards jobs or profits. Infant industries. One of the arguments for international trade restrictions that economists have long recognized as valid, in theory at least, is that of protecting infant industries temporarily until they can develop the skills and experience necessary to compete with long-established foreign competitors. Once this point is reached, the protection, whether tariffs, import quotas, or whatever, can be taken away and the industry allowed to stand or fall in the competition of the marketplace. In practice, however, a new industry in its infancy seldom has enough political muscle, employees' votes, employers' campaign contributions, local governments dependent on their taxes, to get protection from foreign competition. On the other hand, an old, inefficient industry that has seen better days may well have some political muscle left and obtain enough protectionist legislation or subsidies from the government to preserve itself from extinction, at the expense of the consumers, the taxpayers, or both. National Defense. Even the greatest advocates of free trade are unlikely to want to depend on imports of military equipment and supplies from nations that could turn out at some future time to be enemy nations. Therefore, domestic supplies of munitions and weapons of war have long been supported in one way or another in order to assure that those suppliers will be available in the event that they are needed to provide whatever is required for national defense. One of the rare cases in history where a people did depend on potential enemies for military supplies occurred in colonial America, where the indigenous American Indians obtained guns and ammunition from the European settlers. When warfare broke out between them, the Indians could win most of the battles and yet lose the war when they began to run out of bullets, which were available only from the white settlers. Since guns and bullets were products of European civilization, the Indians had no choice but to rely on that source. But countries that do have a choice almost invariably prefer having their own domestic suppliers of the things that are essential to their own national survival. Unfortunately, the term essential to national defense can be and has been stretched to include products only remotely, tangentially, or fictitiously related to military defense. Such products can acquire protection from international competition under a national defense label for purely self-serving reasons. In short, while the argument for international trade restrictions for the sake of national defense can be valid, whether it is or is not valid for a particular industry in a particular country at a particular time depends on the actual circumstances of that industry, that country, and that time. Different foreign countries can represent different probabilities of becoming future enemies, so that the dangers of relying on foreign suppliers of military equipment vary with the particular countries involved. In 2004, for example, Canada was the largest foreign recipient of Pentagon contracts, $601 million worth, followed by Britain and Israel, none of these three countries being likely to be at war with the United States. Sometimes it is not the import of physical goods themselves, but the export of technology embodied in goods, which represents a military threat. In the 1990s, bans on selling American products using advanced computer technology were lifted for sales to China over the objections of U.S. military authorities. The military wished to keep such restrictions because this advanced technology would enable the Chinese military to acquire the ability to more accurately aim nuclear missiles at American cities. It was not economists but politicians who favored lifting such international trade restrictions. Economists have long recognized the national defense exception to free trade as valid where it applies, even though the national defense rationale has been used in many cases where it did not apply. Dumping. A common argument for government protection against a competitor in other countries is that the latter is not competing fairly, but is instead dumping its products on the market at prices below their costs of production. The argument is that this is being done to drive the domestic producers out of business, letting the foreign producer take over the market, after which prices will be raised to monopolistic levels. In response to this argument, governments have passed anti-dumping laws, which ban, restrict, or heavily tax the importation of products from foreign companies declared to be guilty of this practice. Everything in this argument depends on whether or not the foreign producer is in fact selling goods below their costs of production. As already noted in Chapter 6, determining production cost is not easy in practice, even for a firm operating within the same country as the government agencies that are trying to determine its costs. For government officials in Europe to try to determine the production costs of a company located in Southeast Asia is even more problematical, especially when they are simultaneously investigating many dumping charges involving many other companies scattered around the world. All that is easy is for domestic producers to bring such charges when imports are taking away some of their customers. Given the uncertainties of determining cost, the path of least resistance for officials ruling on dumping charges is to accept such charges. Authorities in the European Union, for example, declared that a producer of mountain bikes in Thailand was exporting these bikes to Europe below their cost of production, because he was charging less for the bikes in Europe than such bikes had been selling for in Thailand. However, since there are economies of scale, the Thai producers' costs when selling huge numbers of mountain bikes in Europe were unlikely to be as high as the costs of other producers selling much smaller numbers of mountain bikes within Thailand, where there was far less demand for such a luxury item from a poorer and smaller population. Indeed, this Thai producer's own costs of selling small numbers of mountain bikes in Thailand were likely to be higher per bike than the costs of selling vast numbers of them in large orders to Europe. To sell bikes in Europe for less than bicycle producers charged in Thailand did not necessarily mean selling below the cost of producing bikes for the huge European market. This situation was not unique. The European Union has applied anti-dumping laws against bed linen from Egypt, antibiotics from India, footwear from China, microwave ovens from Malaysia, and monosodium glutamate from Brazil, among other products from other places. Nor is the European Union unique. The United States has applied anti-dumping laws to steel from Japan, aluminum from Russia, and golf carts from Poland, among other products. Without any serious basis for determining the costs of producing these things, U.S. government agencies rely on the best information available, which is often supplied by those American businesses that are trying to keep out competing foreign products. Whatever the theory behind anti-dumping laws, in practice they are part of the arsenal of protectionism for domestic producers at the expense of domestic consumers. Moreover, even the theory is not without its problems. Dumping theory is an international version of the theory of predatory pricing, whose problems were discussed in Chapter 8. Predatory pricing is a charge that is easy to make and hard to either prove or disprove, whether domestically or internationally. Where the political bias is toward accepting the charge, it does not have to be proven. Kinds of restrictions. Tariffs are taxes on imports which serve to raise the prices of those imports, and thus enable domestic producers to charge higher prices for competing products than they could in the face of cheaper foreign competition. Import quotas likewise restrict foreign companies from competing on even terms with domestic producers. Although tariffs and quotas may have the same economic end results, these effects are not equally obvious to the public. Thus, while a $10 tariff on imported widgets may enable the domestic producers of widgets to charge $10 more than they could otherwise, without losing business to foreign producers, a suitable quota limitation on the number of imported widgets can also drive up the price of widgets by $10 through its effect on supply and demand. In the latter case, however, it is by no means as easy for the voting public to see and quantify the effects. What that can mean politically is that a quota restriction which raises the price of widgets by $15 may be as easy for elected officials to pass as a tariff of $10. Sometimes this approach is buttressed by claims that this or that foreign country is being unfair in its restrictions on imports from the United States. But the sad fact is that virtually all countries impose unfair restrictions on imports, usually in response to internal special interests. However, here as elsewhere, choices can only be made among alternatives actually available. Other countries' restrictions deprive both them and us of some of the benefits of international trade. If we do the same in response, it will deprive both of us of still more benefits. If we let them get away with it, this will minimize the losses on both sides. Even more effective disguises for international trade restrictions are health and safety rules applied to imports, rules which often go far beyond what is necessary for either health or safety. Mere red tape requirements can also grow to the point where the time needed to comply adds enough costs to be prohibitive, especially for perishable imports. If it takes a week to get your strawberries through customs, you may as well not ship them. All these measures, which have been engaged in by countries around the world, share with import quotas the political advantage that it is hard to quantify precisely their effect on consumer prices, however large that effect may be. Changing conditions. Over time, comparative advantages change, causing international production centers to shift from country to country. For example, when the computer was a new and exotic product, much of its early development and production took place in the United States. But after the technological work was done that turned computers into a widely used product that many people knew how to produce, the United States retained its comparative advantage in the development of computer software design, but the machines themselves could now be easily assembled in poorer countries overseas, and were. Even computers sold within the United States under American brand names were often manufactured in Asia. By the early 21st century, The Economist magazine reported, Taiwan now makes the vast majority of the world's computer components. This pattern extended beyond the United States and Taiwan. As the Far Eastern Economic Review reported, Asian firms heavily rely on U.S., Japanese, and European firms as the dominant sources of new technology. While the Asian manufacturers make razor-thin profit margins due to the hefty licensing fees charged by the global brand firms. The computer software industry in the United States could not have expanded so much and so successfully if most American computer engineers and technicians were tied down with the production of machines that could have been just as easily produced in some other country. Since the same American labor cannot be in two places at one time, it can move to where its comparative advantage is greatest only if the country loses jobs where it has no comparative advantage. That is why the United States could have unprecedented levels of prosperity and rapidly growing employment at the very times when media headlines were regularly announcing layoffs by the tens of thousands in some American industries and by the hundreds of thousands in others. Regardless of the industry or the country, if a million new and well-paying jobs are created in companies scattered all across the country as a result of international free trade, that may carry less weight politically than if half a million jobs are lost in one industry where labor unions and employer associations are able to raise a clamor. When the million new jobs represent a few dozen jobs here and there in innumerable businesses scattered across the nation, there is not enough concentration of economic interest and political clout in any one place to make it worthwhile to mount a comparable counter-campaign. Therefore, laws are often passed restricting international trade for the benefit of some concentrated and vocal constituency, even though these restrictions may cause far more losses of jobs nationwide. The direct transfer of particular jobs to a foreign country, outsourcing, arouses much political and media attention, as when American or British telephone answering jobs are transferred to India, where English-speaking Indians answer calls made to Harrods Department Store in London, or calls to American computer companies for technical information are answered by software engineers in India. There is even a company in India called Tutor Vista, which tutors American students by phone, using 600 tutors in India to handle 10,000 subscribers in the United States. Those who decry the numbers of jobs transferred to another country almost never state whether these are net losses of jobs. While many American jobs have been outsourced to India and other countries, many other countries outsource jobs to the United States. The German company Siemens employs tens of thousands of Americans in the United States, and so do Japanese automakers Honda and Toyota. As of 2006, 63% of the Japanese brand automobiles sold in the United States were manufactured in the United States. The total number of Americans employed by foreign multinational companies runs into the millions. How many jobs are being outsourced in one direction compared to how many are being outsourced in the other direction changes with the passage of time. During the period from 1977 to 2001, the number of jobs created in the United States by foreign-owned multinational companies grew by 4.7 million, while the number of jobs created in other countries by American-owned multinational companies grew by just 2.8 million. However, during the last decade of that era, more American jobs were sent abroad by American multinational companies than there were jobs created in the United States by foreign multinationals. Not only is the direction of outsourcing volatile and unpredictable, the net difference in number of jobs is small compared to the country's total employment. Moreover, such comparisons leave out the jobs created in the economy as a whole as a result of greater efficiency and wealth created by international transactions. Even a country which is losing jobs to other countries on net balance through outsourcing may nevertheless have more jobs than it would have had without outsourcing. That is because the increased wealth from international transactions means increased demand for goods and services in general, including goods and services produced by workers in purely domestic industries. Free trade may have wide support among economists, but its support among the public at large is considerably less. An international poll conducted by The Economist magazine found more people in favor of protectionism than of free trade in Britain, France, Italy, Australia, Russia, and the United States. Part of the reason is that the public has no idea how much protectionism costs and how little net benefit it produces. It has been estimated that all the protectionism in the European Union countries put together saves no more than a grand total of 200,000 jobs at a cost of $43 billion. That works out to about $215,000 a year for each job saved. In other words, if the European Union permitted 100% free international trade, every worker who lost his job as a result of foreign competition could be paid $100,000 a year in compensation, and the European Union countries would still come out ahead. Alternatively, of course, the displaced workers could simply go find other jobs. Whatever losses they might encounter in the process do not begin to compare with the staggering costs of keeping them working where they are. That is because the costs are not simply their salaries, but the even larger costs of producing in less efficient ways, using up scarce resources that would be more productive elsewhere. In other words, what the consumers lose greatly exceeds what the workers gain, making the society as a whole worse off. Another reason for public support for protectionism is that many economists do not bother to answer either the special interests or those who oppose free trade for ideological reasons. The arguments of both have essentially been refuted centuries ago and are now regarded within the economics profession as beneath consideration. For example, as far back as 1828, British economist Nassau W. Senior wrote, "High wages, instead of preventing our manufacturers from competing with foreign countries, are, in fact, a necessary consequence of the very cause which enables us to compete with them, namely, the superior productiveness of English labor." But economists' disdain for long-refuted fallacies has only allowed vehement and articulate spokesmen to have a more or less free hand to monopolize public opinion, which seldom hears more than one side of the issue. One of the few leading contemporary economists to bother answering protectionist arguments has been internationally renowned economist Jagdish Bhagwati, who agreed to a public debate against Ralph Nader. Here was his experience. Faced with the critics of free trade, economists have generally reacted with contempt and indifference, refusing to get into the public arena to engage the critics in battle. I was in a public debate with Ralph Nader on the campus of Cornell University a couple of years ago. The debate was in the evening, and in the afternoon I gave a technical talk on free trade to the graduate students of economics. I asked, at its end, how many were going to the debate, and not one hand went up. Why? I asked. The typical reaction was, why waste one's time? As a consequence, of the nearly 1,000 students who jammed the theater where the debate was held, the vast majority were anti-free traders, all rooting for Mr. Nader. Because the buzzword globalization has been coined to describe the growing importance of international trade and global economic interdependence, many tend to see international trade and international financial transactions as something new, allowing both special interests and ideologues to play on the public's fear of the unknown. However, the term globalization also covers more than simple free trade among nations. It includes institutional rules governing the reduction of trade barriers and the movements of money. Among the international organizations involved in creating these rules are the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization. These rules are legitimate subjects of controversy, though these are not all controversies about free trade.